I was underwhelmed, but everyone else was convinced they had seen something unexplainable. What are your thoughts on the Marfa Lights? This is from Jeffrey Trout of El Paso. The Texanist has attempted to view the mysterious illuminations outside Marfa no fewer than a dozen times over the past 30-some-odd years, Mr. Trout, and each time he has also been disappointed with what he witnessed. In fact, the Texanist never spied anything that he could, even by the longest stretches of the imagination, call the Marfa Lights. So you'll forgive the Texanist if he doesn't sympathize with your dissatisfaction. At least you saw something. But did you really see the Marfa Lights? Or did you merely see some lights in the vicinity of Marfa? As you may be aware, Marfa's famous luminosities have been on the radar of Texans for at least as long as Marfa has been Marfa. In fact, the year of the town's founding, 1883, is the same year in which a young cowboy, Robert Reed Ellison, is reported to have witnessed the lights. Ellison's account is oft noted as the first recorded sighting, although there are tales of Native Americans having earlier witnessed the lights. Since then, the lights have become a major attraction. In 2003, the Texas Department of Transportation even built a roadside viewing center 9 miles east of Marfa on U.S. 90. The oodles of scientific studies that have been conducted over the decades have confirmed a couple of things. Strange lights of an unknown source do occasionally appear outside Marfa, and regular old everyday lights are often confused for the strange lights whose source is a mystery. One of the most dedicated Marfa lights researchers is James Bunnell, a retired aerospace engineer who grew up in Presidio County. Bunnell studied the lights for a dozen years, beginning in the early 2000s, and has written 4 books on the subject. Mr. Bunnell, who is 79 years old and lives in the Fort Worth area, was happy to talk to the Texanist about his own experiences with the lights, as well as what you may or may not have seen. Bunnell figures that you likely observed headlights of cars traveling between Marfa and Presidio on US 67, and not the actual lights. The actual lights are a rare occurrence, Bunnell said. If you really want to see them, you have to be very patient. According to Bunnell's research, about 97% of what people think are the Marfa lights are the result of explainable sources, such as a vehicle headlights, train lights, ranch lights, low-flying aircraft, Air Force blimps, satellites, stars, lightning, sprites, or lightning-like flash, trash fires, brush fires, oil fires, fireworks, fireflies, and folks horsing around. Sightings of a number of these things, not including the fireworks, fireflies, and the beautiful stars that the West Texas night sky is known for, could, in the Texanist opinion, leave a person underwhelmed. Now, in chatting with the Texanist, recounting his first sighting, which occurred when he was maybe 4 or 5 years old, his granddad took him out to see the mysterious Marfa lights one evening, and they did indeed end up seeing some lights. But Bunnell didn't recall the experience as being life-altering and thinks now what he saw that night were probably just car lights. Years later, though, in 2000, he took his wife out to a viewing area east of Marfa to look for lights, and they were treated to an amazing show. These were definitely not car lights, he said. I was blown away. Not to disappoint you any more than you already are disappointed, but the Texanist is of the mind that you are not similarly blown away by what you saw, then what you saw was likely something other than the real deal. Thus, your underwhelmed response is perfectly understandable. Next question for this issue. From reading your columns over the years, I know you've lived in Austin for a long time, but if you had to move to another part of Texas, where would you move? Your hometown of Temple, your beloved North Padre, Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Marfa? You must have given this some thought. This is from Caleb Scarborough of Houston. You are correct, Mr. Scarborough. Texanist does indeed currently reside in Austin, just as he has since 1984 when he decided to leave Temple, the town in which he was born and bred, to broaden his horizons at a public institution of higher learning some 60 miles down the road. Capital of Texas is a wonderful place to reside, and the Texanist has no regrets about having thrown down stakes there. It has an excellent music scene, great food scene, a spring-fed swimming hole you can walk to from downtown, a college football team that occasionally doesn't break the Texan's heart, and an undercurrent of its countercultural past, which still allows for a laid-back vibe. The Texanist has often said that he's going to live in Texas, and he always has and always will. He's going to do so in Austin. Also correct in noting that the Texanist has occasionally given idle thought to life outside Austin, but would the Texanist ever move back to Temple? fine town, especially so now that the never-ending I-35 construction nears its end. And it was a delightful place in which to grow up. There were, after all, woods, a creek, fishing ponds, a drive-in movie theater, two, in fact, skating rink, a Sonic, and loose rules with regard to openly carrying BB guns. What more could a boy want? Texanist wouldn't change a thing about Temple or his upbringing. But sadly, the Texanist is an orphan of Temple these days. Got neither people nor holdings there anymore. Thus, the draw just isn't there. North Padre? The Texanist has been visiting this island community's beautiful beaches and salty lagunas since before he can remember, more than 50 years now. It's one of his favorite places. Too much of a good thing, he fears, would ruin the whole coastal getaway aspect of his visits to that sandy paradise. For this reason, the Texanist doesn't think he'd ever want to be a full-time islander. How about Houston? The Texanist likes Space City plenty and is always struck by the diversity of its populace, the wealth of its cultural offerings, and the sheer bigness of Texas's biggest metropolis. But he couldn't live in Houston for the same reason he never considered living in Dallas, which he likes for similar reasons. Texanist just isn't a city boy. In his inner hayseed wouldn't be comfortable in either place. Yes, it's true, Austin is no longer the quaint hamlet it once was, but that laid-back vibe the Texanist mentioned can make it feel like one in a way that Dallas and Houston just do not. San Antonio? Even though it's now bigger than Big D, the Texanist loves San Antonio. But if he were to ever move to the home of the puppy taco, he fears that he would become Puffy himself. San Antonio, home of the puffy Texanist. Doesn't have a very good ring to it. Marfa? The Texanist digs far west Texas. Ever since attending summer camp in Fort Davis, he's had a soft spot for that area of the state. There are a few places in Texas, or anywhere for that matter, that possess such scenic beauty. Mountainous high desert terrain, pleasant climate, mysterious lights, the wide openness of it all. What's not to like? Well, the desolation, perhaps. The Texanist is a neighborly sort, and the neighbors out there, friendly as they are, can be fairly far flung. Texanist doesn't much like the idea of having to make a 20-minute drive just to borrow a cup of sugar, but he salutes those who have chosen that life for themselves. Man, there are a lot of great places in Texas, but another thing about Austin, in addition to its many aforementioned amenities, it's that it's also, due to its central location, a perfect place from which to springboard to the rest of the state. Even Texas's farthest reaches are relatively, and the Texanist emphasizes relatively, short hops away. Hoo boy! Texanist may need a nap, he's a little tuckered out from daydreaming about so many of his favorite places in Texas, which is to say, so many of his favorite places in the world. But before he stretches out, let the Texanist ask you this, Mr. Scarborough. Where in Texas would you choose to reside if you didn't already live in Houston? Our next one, we have here the Texanist. This is from the issue from December of last year, 2019. And let's see. We have the Texanist here, the first question. I'm enjoying a nice beach vacation with my in-laws in New Jersey, and the house just across from us is flying a Texas flag, an American flag, and a New Jersey flag. However, the Texas flag is flying upside down. As a lifelong Texan, what's my duty here? Kindly point it out to these neighbors? Sneak over in the wee hours and fix it for them? Or just let it go? This is from John Hancock of Dallas. Good eye, John Hancock, and thanks for taking time away from your vacation to execute your patriotic duty by alerting the Texans to this flagrant snafu involving the flying of Texas's revered standard. Any Texan worth their salt knows that the flag should always be flown right side up, which is to say, white stripe on top and red stripe on bottom, except, and this is important, as a single of dire distress and an instance of extreme danger to life or property. It's right there in the section 3100.053 of the Texas Government Code. This is why, of the three options you're considering, the Texanist strongly advises that you exercise option number one. Your New Jersey beach town neighbor, as odd as it may seem, might well be a fellow Texan in urgent need of your assistance. They could be in all sorts of trouble. What if their house has been shanghaied by Snooki and the rest of the Jersey Shore cast? What if former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is commandeered their stretch to the beach, or maybe they're just running low on Mexican martini fixings. Who knows? Thankfully, chances are that your neighbor is not in serious distress and has simply bungled the hoisting of the flag. That wouldn't be the first time. One afternoon back in 2012, the Texanist was whiling away an afternoon gazing out his office window, which is in the heart of downtown Austin, when he suddenly noticed that the Texas flag flying atop the Ernest O. Thompson State Office Building was upside down. Duly alarmed, the the Texanist, not having the phone number to the Ernest O. Thompson State Office Building handy, but knowing that the building sits next door to the governor's mansion, got on the horn to the governor immediately. Maybe he tweeted about it. He really can't remember. Either way, the flag was quickly righted, and the Texanist went home and, after his usual bedtime tonics, slept soundly, knowing that he had done a deed that needed doing. All of this is to say you shouldn't think of the person flying that upside-down Texas flag in New Jersey as a stranger. This individual, as the Texanist mentioned, is likely as not a fellow Texan in need of a neighborly nudge, encouraging them to rectify their bollocked-up banner. But again, they may also be, though the Texanist hoped they aren't, a fellow Texan in need of actual assistance. Whatever the case, if he or she is indeed a fellow Texan, the Texanist trusts that they'll help you out with the flip-flop on the other foot. The Texanist sure hopes everything works out all right. Please report back and let him know, though. He's not going to sleep well until you do, even with extra tonics. Next question, the other one for this issue. I followed my Texas-born and raised wife back to Lone Star State 5 years ago. One of the many things I've learned since then is that there is only one natural lake in Texas. Back up in Washington State, where I come from, there are many such lakes. How did all the other lakes appear in Texas? This is from Scott Bishop, who lives in Southlake. The Texanist is impressed with how well you've acclimated to the unfamiliar land in which you found yourself. You arrived just 5 short years ago, and yet you've already managed to let loose with one of Texas's most pervasive yarns, as ably as any Texan the Texanist has ever heard. Did the Texanist say yarns? Yes, he did, for the simple reason that the oft-repeated fact that the Lone Star State is home to but one single solitary natural lake is false on two grounds. In actual fact, there are plenty of natural lakes in Texas, and the lake you surely have in mind, East Texas's Caddo Lake, isn't one of them. Not entirely, anyway. It's a long story, but a few centuries ago, the Red River, which serves as Texas's northern border with Oklahoma before running down through Louisiana, started getting clogged up with fallen trees. Over the decades, the plug grew and grew, eventually reaching more than 100 miles in length. The Red River Raft, as this wonder of nature came to be known, was such a massive jam that it caused a great deal of water to back up into the river's various tributaries. One of them, Big Cypress Bayou in Texas's northeast corner, is the waterway upon which Caddo Lake formed. After the raft was cleared by the federal government in the late 1800s, Caddo drained a bit before the outflow was staunched by a man-made dam in 1914, preserving the impressive body of water that both Texans and Louisianans had already started making commercial and recreational use of. In the Texanist's opinion, the scenic beauty possessed by today's Caddo Lake, with its ancient Spanish moss-draped cypress trees, is unsurpassed. But is Caddo Lake a natural lake? Well, if you don't look too closely, you can maybe sort of see it that way. But even if we do categorize it as a natural lake, it would not, contrary to popular lore, be Texas's only one. The truth is that Texas has numerous natural lakes. Eagle Lake in Colorado County is at least as natural as Caddo. So is Green Lake in Calhoun County. Plus, there are the Resacas in South Texas and the Panhandle Playa Lakes. Not counting its deserty western portion, Texas is actually pretty darn damp. In fact, there are about 7,000 lakes made by both Mother Nature and man scattered across the state, and the majority of them found in the wetter eastern third of the state. Some of these were smallish affairs of the sort into which the Texanist will occasionally drop a badly hooked key shot, but others are great big bodies of water like Possum Kingdom Lake, Toledo Bend Reservoir, Grapevine Lake in your neck of the woods. Altogether, including rivers and streams, Texas is possessed of enough inland water to rank it right up there among the wettest of the lower 48 states. But as you might have guessed, Texas does indeed have a lot of man-made lakes, and they're here for a reason. As you probably learned in your 5 years of Texanhood, your new home can be unpredictable when it comes to the weather. Precipitation especially can be hit and miss. Sometimes the rain comes in gigantic Texas-sized buckets, and sometimes those buckets are filled with hot wind, tumbling tumbleweeds and dust. To deal with these occasional bouts of flooding and drought, Texans have, over time, constructed numerous large reservoirs across the state. Most of these came into existence after the devastating drought of the 50s, also known as The Time It Never Rained, which was the title of Elmer Kelton's novel set during this particularly parched period. 100 years ago, there were only 8 major reservoirs in Texas. By 1960, there was more than 100. Today, there are more than 200 dotting the Texas landscape. South Lake, where you live, is called South Lake because, as you probably know, it sits south of Grapevine Lake, which was impounded in 1952 when Denton Creek was dammed. The fringe benefits the drought and flood control, of course, are hydroelectric power generation and watery recreation, which are both nice, especially in the summer. As you know, it gets hot here. So to sum up, contrary to what you and frankly too many other Texans have come to believe, Caddo Lake is not Texas's only natural lake, and it may not even qualify as a natural lake at all. The Texanist believes this matter to be now settled. Thanks for the letter. Welcome to Texas. Now your time here be wet and wild. Next up, we have the Texas Monthly from January of this year, and we have our Texanist offering fine advice and keen observation since 2007. Just a reminder, the Texanist is senior editor David Courtney. Send him your questions at texanist@texasmonthly.com and be sure to tell him where you're from. Our first question today, Texanist, you're hardly a Texan if you're one of those pesky liberals. Would transplantist not be a better handle? Name withheld. And the answer, the Texanist receives a fair amount of mail. He asks for it right there in the fine print of each column he writes. See it just up there on the right? Most of what lands in his inbox are pleas for assistance with vexing situations, arcane conundrums of a Texasy nature, or friendly comments on recent columns. Occasionally, the Texanist gets mail from prison, which can be interesting, and every so often, he'll get a rambling, incoherent note from somebody he suspects of being drunker than Cooter Brown. Those can also be interesting. Recently, the Texanist received your brief email, Mr. or Ms. Withheld, and although he isn't able to ascertain precisely what the Texanist might have written or said or done that spurred you to send it, he seems to be catching a slight whiff of disgruntlement. So despite the fact that you're in flagrant violation of the rules of writing to the Texanist, didn't reveal where you're from or even volunteer your name, a response seems to be in order. And that response is, the Texanist, on behalf of all Texans, is greatly affronted by your narrow definition of who qualifies as a Texan. The intensity of his affrontedness is likely due to the fact that as a recipient of piles of misses over the years, Texanist has had prime seat in the glorious pageantry that is the vibrant mosaic of Texas's citizenry. At various junctures, the Texanist guesses he's heard from conservative Texans, liberal Texans, moderate Texans, libertarian Texans, pacifist Texans, vegetarian Texans, straight Texans, and LGBTQ Texans, not to mention the occasional lost Oklahoman or curious Californian. And the Okies and Californians accepted, all of those folks have one thing in common. Whatever their political, religious, sexual, or cowboy boot toe shape inclinations, they were all Texans. As is, it should go without saying, the Texanist. Your crack about him being a transplant is a calumny. Just like his forebears for generations, the Texanist is a native. Have you ever noticed that Texas is a fairly sizable place? Well, you know what often accompanies size? Variety. When you've got 29,087,070 notoriously individualistic people living amid more than 268,000 square miles of megacities, charming small towns, and anodyne suburbs, it's pretty much guaranteed that you're going to find a few disagreements between them. Yet we all manage to live in relative comity. It's because Texans of all stripes, not including those who withhold their names and locations apparently, are mostly content to live and let live. It's a philosophy that has held Texans in good stead for many, many years now, and one you would do well to adopt. You see, the logical conclusion of your hostility toward those who think differently than yourself is something of an absurdity. Do you really mean to suggest that the millions of Texans who identify as liberal aren't Texans? That LBJ wasn't a Texan? That neither the great folklorist and foe of McCarthyism, J. Frank Dobie, nor his antagonist-turned-friend, Americo Paredes, were Texan? Nor statesperson nonpareil Barbara Jordan? Nor Ann Richards? For land's sake, Willie Nelson may be the greatest Texan of all time, and on many issues, as you surely know, he is quite liberal. As to whether or not the Texanist is himself a member of that august group, let him offer this brief response. That's none of your damn business, thank you very much. Of course, the Texanist does have personal opinions on all manner of subjects. Sometimes people come to him for just those opinions. But much as it is with the long-held rule of etiquette that deems discussion of religion, politics, and sexuality off-limits at parties, so too the Texanist feels that it is not a very good idea to delve into such topics whilst working in the advice-giving trade, and so he demurs. In short, you might think about showing a little more kindness toward the Texanist than the 29,087,068 other Texans who share this wonderful and wonderfully diverse place we call home. And if you can't, well, maybe it is you who should transplant yourself, perhaps to a place where the official motto isn't friendship. Our next and last question for this issue. It's that time of year again. Temperature barely dips below 32 degrees Fahrenheit. All the TV weather reporters invariably characterize the conditions as a hard freeze. In ski country and up north, the forecasters simply report 12 degrees or minus 2 degrees without offering any reminder that water freezes at 32 degrees. We Texans are quite familiar with the concept of ice, so my question is, why do Texas weather folks always say hard freeze? It's from Cecil Cole of Austin. The Texanist feels your pain, Mr. Cole. He was also once of a mind that TV weathercasters were too often overly sensational with regard to their recaps and outlooks, especially during the summer when the Texas weather can become downright monotonous. At times, it feels like insult is intentionally being added to injury. In fact, back in the summer of 2016, the Texanist went off on meteorologists who he thought were talking way too much about the heat index. It's hot. Can we just leave it at that? Pleaded the Texanist. Then some months later, after the arrival of that first blue norther, when both the weather and the Texanist had cooled down a bit, he came to realize that the heat index, which actually takes the actual temperature and factors in the relative humidity to come up with a feels-like temperature, does serve a purpose, namely increasing the safety and well-being of his less hardy fellow Texans, and he felt a little remorseful for berating the well-intentioned weather folks. The irritation with which you've come to the Texanist is a similar one. But just as it is with the heat index warnings, there is also, believe it or not, a legitimate distinction between a freeze and a hard freeze. Dr. John Nielsen Gammon, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at Texas A&M University, who serves as a state climatologist, explained to the Texanist that a hard freeze occurs when the air temperature falls to 28 degrees or lower and then stays below 32 for long enough to freeze vegetation. The significance of a hard freeze as opposed to a freeze is mainly the impact on plants. It's really more of an agricultural concern than a meteorological one, Nielsen Gammon said. See, a forecast that calls for the temperature to hit 32 or 31 or even 29 degrees and then rise back above freezing fairly quickly doesn't present as much of a threat to what are known as the four P's, plants, pets, pipes, and people, as does a forecast calling for temperatures to drop to, say, 25 and then stay below freezing for a good stretch. Whether a person happens to be a produce farmer in a winter garden in South Texas, a rancher in North Texas, or just a homeowner in Bastrop worried about the health of their toilet drain pipe, a heads up about such conditions can be quite useful. The reason weather reporters in more northern parts of the country are not as quick to use the term hard freeze is simply because the folks up north with their snowblowers and doggy jackets are no strangers to such frosty conditions. While it can get mighty chilly here, Texans are often surprised when it gets cold enough to interrupt the year-round growing season that much of our state enjoys, and we benefit from a little goosing when our plants and other peas are at risk. Interestingly, Nielsen Gannon points out that, conversely, because Texans are well accustomed to excessively hot weather, the threshold for heat warnings is higher here than it is in more northern areas. This is simply a matter of Texans being able to take the heat, he said. So in a nutshell, while it is true that any mercury level that dips below 32 degrees Fahrenheit is technically freezing cold, there's a real difference between that and a hard freeze. Think of it as the difference in the relative coldness of a well digger's derriere and a witch's bosom in a brass brassiere, or the other way around. Either way, stay warm. It's cold out there. We turn now next to the, February issue, 2020. And this is, again, the Texanist. Big first question here. I've been wearing a Stetson Open Road for at least 15 years now, but I hardly ever wear it these days. The reason is that the Open Road and felt Western hats in general seem to have suddenly become exceedingly popular. Hipsters have commandeered these hats, and when I put mine on, I feel like a copycat, which I am not. Have we hit peak open road? It's from Marty Reed of Dallas. Here's our answer. The Texanist is a man of many hats, not just metaphorical ones. He wears actual ones, too, including an indestructible wide-brimmed Mexican palm straw and a Gus, the handsome silver-belly lid that's so named because it's a replica of the hat worn by Augustus Gus McCrae in a Lonesome Dove miniseries. The Texanist Gus was made for him by famed hatmaker Manny Gamage, the man who designed the original Gus at his Texas Hatter shop way back when it was located off I-35 in Buda, now located off US 183 in Lockhart. You'll be happy or perhaps upset to know that the Texanist is also the proud owner of an open road. This particular topper has been in the Texanist possession for 4 or 5 years, but his very first open road was purchased during his college days in the late 80s at Joseph's Man's Shop, now defunct old-time haberdashery, is located on Congress Avenue in downtown Austin. For the uninitiated, Stetson's Open Road is one of the iconic hat manufacturer's most iconic styles. It's a model that's found atop the noggins of Presidents Harry S. Truman, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and Lyndon Baines Johnson. Hat is so closely associated with the 36th president, in fact, it is often referred to simply as the LBJ hat, or just the LBJ. It's a classic, subtly Western-style hat that has a 4 1/4 inch crown with cattleman's crease and a short for cowboy hat anyway, 2 3/4 inch brim with a sharp-looking trim ribbon-bound edge, which is the hat's most distinguishing feature. Historically, it's been the perfect hat for the rancher, bank president, doctor, musician, politician, service station owner, shopkeeper, postal worker, elevator operator, railroad engineer, college professor, high school football coach, hotel manager, to barkeep, and so forth. And it is still so it is today, though there are a lot fewer elevator operators around than there once were. The open road's staying power is a testament to its timeless design. It's really a fine-looking hat. The fact that folks, including the gals these days, want to wear one isn't at all surprising. And as for your observation that there has been a recent spike in the number of open road hats you found perched atop the heads of Texans, you and the Texanist are in complete agreement. You and the Texanist diverge greatly, however, on whether more hats on the heads of more Texans is a bad thing, whether or not the hat wearers in question happen to be artisanal candle makers or ridiculously mustachioed baristas. The Texanist is of the firm belief that this is not a bad thing at all. He's not in the least bit concerned that there are too many hat wearers walking around nowadays. No, sir. The way the Texanist sees it, the problem is that despite this recent uptick in chapeau sporting, there are still too few folks donning hats. You ever been to a cattle auction or a small town cafe, coffee time, Mr. Reed? Everybody there has had it. Everybody. And it's the Texanist's dream that one day the whole of Texas will resemble one of these splendid places. Nothing, in fact, would please him more than to exit his downtown office building in Austin and wade into a sea of hat-wearing Texans, no matter how many tattoos, body piercings, or funny-looking mustaches they may have. The Texanist, by the way, is not the only denizen of the capital city. He's a fan of cowboy hats. Texas legislature, in all of its wisdom, and really this decision may have constituted all of its wisdom, designated the cowboy hat the official headwear of Texas in 2015, and it's found no reason to reverse course on that resolution since. In the same spirit, Texanist would urge you not to hang up your hat for good. In addition to keeping your head warm in the winter and shady in summer, wearing that hat is your civic duty. Plus, doing so made you happy once and will no doubt do so again. Have we reached peak open road? For the sake of all that is Texan, the Texanist sure hopes not. And that conveniently brings us to the halfway point of our program. I'm going to remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year, it marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, or perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listen at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Radio since 1967. We return to our text, which is a big O happy Texanist party today, and we're going to get the second question of February 2020 right now. I've had a recurring discussion with people over the past few months about salsa and hot sauce and the difference between the two. Most all of them point to articles they find online that say hot sauce is more like Cholula and Tabasco, while the stuff that comes with chips at a restaurant is always salsa. But these pieces are typically written by people in regions of the country that don't eat hot sauce or salsa on a regular basis. So I've come to you for assistance. Personally, I feel that hot sauce is any type of sauce with a more liquid consistency and spicier flavor, and that salsa has more of a chunky pico de gallo type of consistency. But what say you? Is from Jason Gallegos of Fort Worth. Answer, what to call a particular piquant potion as opposed to another piquant potion is a hot topic of conversation around these parts. Is it hot sauce or is it salsa? The answer, as you have learned, depends on whom you ask. Here in Texas, we're blessed with an endless variety of both hot sauces and salsas, including, but by no means limited to, red ones, green ones, orange ones, jarred ones, bottled ones, canned ones, and fresh ones, like the mean pico de gallo or beak of the cock the Texans occasionally whips up at home. Among these, there are thick ones, spicy ones, thin ones, mild ones, chunky ones, vinegary ones, and combinations upon combinations thereof. As a small evidentiary sampling, consider the classic Mexican-style bottled hot sauces or salsas picantes, such as Cholula, Valentina, and Tapatio, and Louisiana-style bottled hot sauces such as Crystal, Tabasco, and the eponymous Louisiana. Then, too, there's bottled peppery sauce, the clear-rich vinegary staple of the southern table. Additionally, Texans are no strangers to chili sauces, such as Sriracha Rucha sauce and the like, as well as Chinese chili oils and Southeast Asian sambals. And then there are the salsas frescas, such as the pico de gallos and the familiar Mexican-style salsas found in the condiment aisles of our grocery stores and accompanying the baskets of chips at our Tex-Mex eateries. Nearly all salsas, as we know them, are technically speaking hot sauces. After all, most of them are spicy, and salsa is, of course, the Spanish word for salt. So to reiterate, salsa is a type of hot sauce, but that's not what most of us mean when we say hot sauce. The consensus among the random Texans the Texan has consulted for his informal poll is that, as you stated, hot sauces are thinner in consistency and most often shaken onto other foodstuffs, while salsas are chunkier and usually put to use as dips, such as one finds alongside the aforementioned chips. The complication is that the Texanist has in his lifetime enjoyed numerous spicy blends he regards as salsas that were as thin and runny as straight tomato juice, and has also asked waitstaff on more occasions than he can remember for refills of hot sauce when referring to the stuff that goes with the chips. Does that answer your question? The Texan sure hopes so, because his head hurts from thinking about all this, and he's really thirsty for another margarita. Well, we don't get to stop for margarita, but we do get to go to the next issue of Texas Monthly, which is March of this year, and we have the Texanist again. Offering fine advice and observations since 2007, the Texanist is senior editor David Courtney. You can send him your questions at Texanist@TexasMonthly.com. Be sure to tell him where you're from. And the first question from our March issue is, I recently learned that in baseball, a pop fly that falls between the infield and outfield and results in a base hit is known as a Texas leaguer. And now I'm curious about the term's origin. You know why a Texas leaguer is called a Texas leaguer? This by Richie Sawyer from Lufkin. Answer is, that's a good baseball trivia question, Mr. Sawyer. Thanks for sending it. But as good as the query is, the answer is even better. The idiom, it turns out, dates back from the early 1890s when Ollie Pickering, a native Illinoisan who was playing for the nascent Texas League's Houston Mudcats, made baseball history. On May 21st, 1892, Pickering hit a whopping 7 singles. To this day, the most singles ever hit by an individual player in a Texas League game. The really remarkable thing, though, is that each and every one of these singles was reportedly the result of a weakly hit bloop that found its way just far enough over the infield to drop uncaught into the outfield. So extraordinary was the feat that news of it spread far and wide, and such hits thereafter came to be known as Texas leaguers. A few other accounts of the term's origin exist, but this is the one the Texanist finds the most credible and the most fun. And speaking of fun, the Texanist thought it would be a hoot to offer an unsolicited, annotated list of other phrases to begin with the magical word Texas. This is not, of course, a complete list, but it's a pretty impressive grouping nonetheless. Enjoy! Texas caviar, a delicious party dish starring pickled black-eyed peas, is made famous by famous Texas transplant chef Helen Corbett. Texas dip is an ostentatiously deep curtsy performed by Texas debutantes on the occasion of their social entrees. Texas exit, an informal and illegal highway off-ramp blazed through the grassy strip separating a main thoroughfare and a frontage road by Texans with better places to be than stuck in traffic. A Texas rig is an advancement in sport fishing developed on Lake Tyler in the middle part of the 20th century, whereby a plastic worm is hooked in an ingenious manner that prevents dastardly snags. A Texas sheet cake, or sheath cake, if you're the Texan's zero cake-making mother-in-law. A large, like Texas, chocolate cake is baked on a sheet pan before getting dotted with pecan bits and sheathed in sweet chocolate icing. Texas toast is bread that is sliced at twice the normal thickness, about 3/4 inch, and liberally buttered or margarined or oiled and then toasted or sometimes grilled to a golden brown, most likely the 1941 invention of Royce Haley at Beaumont's Pigstand Drive-In Restaurant. As far as toasted breads go, Texas toast is, in the Texan's mind, the best thing since sliced bread of average thickness. A Texas Tommy, a hot dog's been split lengthwise, filled with cheese, wrapped with bacon, and then grilled or fried, as well as the name of a jaunty swing dance. Oddly, the Texanist has uncovered an actual Texas connection with neither and cannot explain the appellation in either case. A Texas toothpick, this phrase may refer to a pocket knife made by W.R. Case & Sons Cutlery Company of Pennsylvania, a combination of fried jalapeno and onion strips, or an actual toothpick crafted from the penis bone of a raccoon. To the Texanist knowledge, none have any specific tie to Texas other than the fact that at various times the Texanist father found uses for all three. Texas Towers is a set of three U.S. Air Force radar surveillance stations positioned off the east coast of the United States during the Cold War and so named because the platforms were modeled after offshore drilling platforms first used off the Texas coast. And number 10, a Texas Titty Twister. A purple nurple has been Texas up a notch by way of an additional half twist. That's 10. The Texanist could keep going, but he's filled the space allotted for a response to your fascinating query. If he'd had a little more room, he'd mention Texas Longhorns, Texas D, Texas Two-Step, Texas Stop Sign, Texas Wedge, Texas Catheter, and many more. Thanks for the Texas question, Texas Pen Pal. Our next question, second one for that issue. As a native Texan, I've traveled my fair share of the state. Often as I gaze out the window, I've noticed something that puzzles me. What's up with the grills at roadside parks and restaurants? When, in the history of Texas travels, have folks loaded up for a trip to Grandma's or Padre Island with luggage, a bag of charcoal, and 5 pounds of raw meat for a cookout on the side of the road? I'm confident you have friends at the Texas Department of Transportation who can help solve this mystery. What is? It's from Curtis Watson of Grapevine. Texas, as the Texanist has noted before, is home to more roadways than any other state in the country, some 80,000 centerline miles of it, according to the Texas Department of Transportation. Agency that is tasked with the construction and upkeep of much of that blacktop, as well as occasionally assisting the Texanist in his professional endeavors. With all of those 80,000 plus miles of highways and expressways and byways and throughways and this ways and that ways, Texas is, to put it mildly, not lacking when it comes to opportunities for motoring. Just like you, the Texanist loves a good road trip, whether he is hopping over to East Texas for some lake fishing, down to the coast for beach time, out to West Texas to take in some deserty desolation, or up to the Panhandle, a marvel, at Paladura Canyon. The Texanist is always happy to have the opportunity to saddle up and hit the trail. No matter the destination, such sojourning is good for the soul. Sometimes, though, the Texanist is loath to admit he can become so bent on getting where he's going that he can overdo it a little bit with the frequent fervency of his driving. The pupils of his eyes become two tiny specks, reflecting a fast-moving conveyor belt of highway stripes. Like Fritz von Erich applying an iron claw to an opponent's cranium, he tightened his grip on the steering wheel until his knuckles turned white. The Texanist begins to experience a keen regret over not stopping to relieve himself at any of the past four opportunities. Beads of sweat surface on his forehead. This is not safe driving, and the Texanist is not proud of himself. When the Texanist finally comes to his senses, though, he thanks his lucky stars for his TxDOT friends, whom he did reach out to for you, and in so doing, learned a whole truckload about Texas's safety rest areas, which, owing to their actual raison d'etre, is how they are officially known. First of these respite spots were constructed soon after President Lyndon B. Johnson signed into law the Highway Beautification Act of 1965, also known as Lady Bird's Bill. Highway beautification was one of her pet projects. Today, there are 77 such rest stops sprinkled along our beautiful and occasionally not-so-beautiful waysides, and that's not counting a dozen of the larger travel information centers. Main feature in most of these stops, in addition to the restroom facilities, of course, are the picnic areas, each one unique in design. Who could forget the iconic teepee-style structures found in Lajitas, or the 6666 Ranch Barn style in Guthrie, or Winona's kitschy Oil Terrace. Now, not every safety rest area features grills, but many of them do. And the TxDOT folks tell the Texanists that these grills are often used not by the folks on their way to Grandma's or Padre Allen, but by residents of the surrounding communities who often regard rest areas as local parks. A Texanist even learned of one couple who chose not to embark on their journey together as husband and wife by getting hitched at a rest stop. Alas, as we near the end of our own journey together, the Texanist would be remiss not to reiterate the main purpose of the safety rest area, which is not roadside grilling, but, again, safety. Sadly, just as Texas has more roadway than any state in country, studies suggest that so, too, do we have the most traffic accidents caused by driver fatigue. Safety rest areas, as it turns out, are very important features of our sprawling road system. The Texanist recommends taking advantage of them. And heck, while you're at it, go ahead and pack some charcoal and meat. Roadside grilling is still grilling, and grilling is never a bad idea, especially when it's for safety's sake. Happy trails. All right. Next up is our April issue. We've got the Texanist again, offering his fine advice and keen observations in 2007. And his first question today, I met a couple from the UK several years ago in Florida. When I told them I was from Dallas, they said, "Oh, that's where the cattle still roam the streets." They were serious. Shocked, I corrected them and explained that Dallas is very modern, has tall buildings, museums, etc. To this day, I feel guilty for shattering their antiquated view of my city. Was I wrong to do so? It's from John Thomas in Dallas. Answer, it's funny how many folks from around the world who've never visited Texas hold such charmingly ridiculous misconceptions about it. In this day and age, what with the World Wide Web and the universality of so-called smart devices, it actually kind of boggles the mind. Still, just about every Texan who's traveled outside the United States or encountered foreigners, and even some non-Texan Americans inside the United States, has experienced this phenomenon. Thanks to Texas's colorful history, which has been extra colorfully depicted in Western novels and radio shows and movies, everybody in Texas rides a horse, and everybody in Texas carries a six guns, and everybody in Texas incessantly shouts yeehaw, and cattle still roam the streets in Dallas, stereotypes have refused to die. The Texanist can think of no other state as widely and flagrantly misunderstood. But though the Texanist is a card-carrying journalist whose job entails getting facts straight, it is his professional opinion that the pang of remorse you felt over the past few years is not undeserved. For while cattle may not roam Dallas as they did back when John Neely Bryant launched his Trinity River ferry business in the 1840s, the tradition of tall tale telling, a tradition first brought to Texas by the Texanist great-great-great-great-granddad, a Republic era pioneer who introduced Davy Crockett to the sartorial joys of both buckskin and coonskin, does still roam quite freely throughout Texas. Spinning a magical yarn and passing it off as God's honest truth is a Texan's birthright, and you really missed your chance when faced with an audience whose adorable ignorance primed them for a heaping helping of grade-A Lone Star malarkey. Of course, the Texanist wasn't there in Florida and doesn't know all of the relevant circumstances, but regardless, direct response to the British couple's amusing cluelessness would have been puffed up with pride, crank twang up to 11, and assume a persona resembling a combination of Captain Woodrow F. Call, as depicted by Tommy Lee Jones in the television adaptation of Lonesome Dove, and John Wayne in most any of his silver screen cowboy portrayals. They thought cattle still roamed Dallas. There's no way they'd known that Wayne was actually from Iowa. That's right, pilgrims. You might have told them as you casually leaned a badly sunburned arm against a tiki-style bar at Alan Sal's beachside lounge while sipping a frozen drink from a coconut shell with an umbrella in it. Big D is indeed lousy with cattle, fur as the eye can see. Matter of fact, I'm a cow puncher myself. Heck, fire just last week I was poking some dogies along Central Expressway during 5 o'clock drive time and a stampede damn near broke out. It was bumper to bumper, I tell you. Would have been a real calamity had I not been able to lasso the Pamela Parst. We need another key line back. Anywho, as I was saying, well, you get the idea. In short, it is the Texanist's firm belief that an opportunity to entertain tourists with harmless tomfoolery should never be wasted. Next time, don't let yourself or the team down, Pilgrim. And our second question from this issue, there's two in every one. For the first time in a number of years, I find myself with a boyfriend, and I've really been yearning to go on a lovey-dovey getaway with him. We need a little help. Where is the most romantic spot in Texas? Name withheld, but from Midland. Congratulations on landing yourself another beau, Ms. or Mr. Withheld. The Texanist, a man opposed to lonesomeness, except when it inspires cheer-in-the-beer honky-tonk numbers, is glad your drought is finally over. Between you and him, have there been times in the past when the Texanist's own love light shone quite brightly and other times when it was reduced to a dim flicker? All of that was a long time ago, however. Texanist is happy to report that he and Mrs. Texanist are coming up on 20 years of mostly blissful connubial enjoyment this very spring. As such, he is quite familiar with the joys of the romantic getaway, and no such trips occurred more frequently in his salad days, and many of those outings are probably not ones he would recommend to a couple today. The Texanist is happy to help ensure that you won't be entering another epoch sans amour anytime soon. So let him now slip on his couple's counseling hat, arrange the travel brochures on his desk, and offer up a little assistance. It was just alluded to. The time was, the Texanist reckoned, that a spur-of-the-moment overnighter to Nuevo Laredo for frog legs and Ramos gin fizzes at the Cadillac Bar was the very model of an alluring road trip. Then, too, there were slightly less extravagant excursions to dusty small-town tractor pulls, dustier goat-roping events, and saliva-slathered watermelon seed-spitting contests, which the Texanist also regarded as the epitome of romantic travel. Texanist is a little embarrassed to admit it, but he also used to tout like he staycations as fun weekend escapes. It's amazing the Texanist ever found anybody to settle down with him, isn't it? Thankfully, Texas is chock-full of romantic settings, some of which even boast a hint of international flair. So how about a trip over to Gay Prairie in northeast Texas, or ancient Roma down on the border? Or in case you're feeling a little more randy, maybe Sweet Union, south of Rusk in Cherokee County would suit y'all. Venus in Johnson County shares a name with the Roman goddess of love. You might try Loving with a capital L up in North Texas, or maybe Valentine way out west. Hey, Sugar Land. Texanist is mostly kidding. He just thought it'd be fun to point out a few spots whose names alone are redolent of romance. In truth, he'd be able to vouch for only a couple of these places. But all moderately funny bad joking aside, Texas is actually replete with destinations suitable for your needs. And your timing, the Texanist must say, is impeccable. In his humble opinion, there's no time in Texas like springtime in Texas. The weather is warming, wildflowers are beginning to make their appearance, and love, like the smell of freshly cut grass, is in the air. So how about packing light and heading south to the Big Bend area? You ever been to Marathon? Views are inspiring. The few folks you'll encounter are friendly. The White Buffalo Bar at the Gage Hotel is said to be the originator of the delicious ranch water tequila cocktail, which, in the Texanist experience, can be as libido-tickling as any Ramos Gin Fizz. Their nearby hiking options, if you've got the energy, ain't bad either. Texanist might also suggest a trip to the lovely laid-back little seaside town of Port Aransas, where you can kick off your shoes and stroll hand-in-hand neath the setting sun as the waves lap gently at your bare piggies. You can go out and gorge yourselves on fresh-caught fruits of the sea, trip the light fantastic at a salty dive bar and where mezcal body shots are a thing, or maybe a trip to the big city would suit you. High culture, interesting history, good people watching, and debauchery aplenty to be found in Houston, San Antonio, Dallas, Austin, Fort Worth, and El Paso. How about a real change of scenery for you Midlanders? A trip to East Texas. There are lots of tall trees out that way, you know. Lots of pretty lakes for your fishing, boating, and canoodling on the banks needs. Although it was illegal prior to 2011, noodling, or hand fishing, is also acceptable behavior along the banks of Texas's lakes and rivers. Texanist once had a heck of a time on beautiful Toledo Bend Reservoir, the largest lake in Texas. And there's also primal Caddo Lake, a body of water so naturally beautiful, what with the giant Spanish moss-draped cypress trees, as to rival any romantic setting on earth. Come to think of it, the Texanist has had some luck with a number of these spots, and he's certain one of them will work out for you too. And just so you know, Midland is home to not one, but two La Quintas. And coming up right now, we got this last issue. This is the May issue of this year, and this is the Texanist offering fine advice and keen observations since 2007. The Texanist is senior editor David Courtney. You can send him your questions at texanist@texasmonthly.com. Be sure to tell him where you're from. And our first question: wouldn't a stage musical based on the Texas Revolution, featuring the likes of Stephen F. Austin, Sam Houston, William B. Travis, James Fannin, David Crockett, and Ben Milam, be as exciting as Hamilton? Broadway musical based on the life of American founding father Alexander Hamilton? It's from Alex McClellan of McKinney. The Texanist, who had the pleasure of attending a touring performance of Hamilton last summer in Austin, concurs with your assessment that the Texas Revolution would make excellent subject matter for a stage musical. As good as your idea is, however, you're not the first person to be struck by the notion of turning Texas history into the focus of a musical. According to the Handbook of Texas, several plays about the Texas Revolution were written during the early statehood period, including one titled Storming of the Alamo. Additionally, Texas has, since Governor Bill Clements signed Senate Bill 93 into law in 1979, not one, not two, not three, but four official state plays, and each one is a musical drama with some aspect of Texas history as its focus. Fort Griffin Fandango, which started in 1938, is the oldest of the quartet, put on annually in Albany, and relates to the history of the settlement of the area along the Clear Forks of the Brazos River near Fort Griffin, a frontier outpost. Texas, which started in 1966, perhaps the best known of the foursome, is staged beneath a stunning 600-foot-tall cliff at the beautiful Pioneer Amphitheater in Paladura Canyon State Park each summer from June to the middle of August. Texas promotes itself as a musical romance of Texas Panhandle history. Beyond the Sundown, from 1975, delves into the Alabama and Coushatta Indian tribes' fraught decision over who to throw their support behind when the battle for Texas independence got underway. It was mounted for a number of years at the Sundown Amphitheater on the Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas Reservation in East Texas. And The Lone Star, from 1977, which was commissioned by BOI Galveston philanthropist Mary Moody Northern and staged at her namesake amphitheater in Galveston Island State Park, also focused on big events of the Texas Revolution. Sadly, Beyond the Sundown seems to have had its last performance in 1983, and The Lone Star appears to have been backburned since 1990, leaving only Fandango and Texas in regular production. So with only two of Texas's four official state plays still being put on, perhaps the time is right for a sweeping musical spectacular. Set amid the dramatic doings of the Texas Revolution, one can just imagine the many classic songs that would live forever in American standards repertoire. Don't Cry for Me, Madam Morris, Santa Anna, Get Your Gun, I Feel Pretty Sure That We're Badly Outnumbered, and of course the crowd-rousing showstopper, Hello, Davy. Well, who's going to write those songs, though? The Texans would offer to collaborate with you, but he's currently busy thinking about Texas Monthly, the musical. An idea hatched by his across the hall office neighbor, executive editor Michael Hall. The magazine's 50th anniversary, which occurs in just 3 short years, is right around the corner, and there's a riveting melody-filled drama about the travails of a spunky group of writers, editors, and advertising salespeople that has to be flawlessly composed and cast and choreographed between now and then. Definitely want it to be a lot better than Consumer Reports, the musical. Thanks for the letter. Stay in touch. Break the leg. And our second question for today and our last one of today's reading. I'm just a poor old guy from Michigan, born and raised on a small city lot. But I received Texas Monthly, and I enjoy it very much. I even enjoy the advertising because it's so classy and well done. I especially enjoy the real estate ads in the back. I guess I kind of fantasize about owning one of the massive ranches I see for sale. My question is, what in tarnation, and did I use that word correctly, does a person do with 38,000 acres? It's from Herb Bergstrom of Sparta, Michigan. Answer, it warms the cockles of the Texas hardened old heart to learn that a Michigander such as yourself has fallen under the magical spell of Lone Star State by way of the editorial content of the periodical that has employed him as a lowly scrivener all these many years. Folks over in the advertising sales department will be especially glad to hear that you're also enjoying the fruits of their labors. And the Texanist can relate. He has momentarily lost himself in reveries quite similar to yours while lingering over the very same ads touting jaw-droppingly picturesque ranchland. Not uncommon for the unlanded to dream such dreams, after all. Texas, in case you didn't know, comprises some 171,901,440 acres in total, more than twice the size of Michigan, which is half covered in water anyway. 95% of all that Texas land is in the hands of private landowners, some of whom are the masters of gigantic spreads just like the one you and the Texanist are window shopping for. Many of the state's most famed ranches are, in fact, famed mainly for their sheer giganticness. For instance, there's a 500,000-acre Wagoner Ranch up in North Texas, which went on the market a few years ago with an eye-popping asking price of $725 million and sold not long afterward. And then there's the 278,000-acre Coconut 06 Ranch in the beautiful Davis Mountains of West Texas, and the historic 6666 Ranch, which is part of the 275,000-acre Burnett Ranch's empire. And, of course, the Crown Jewel King Ranch, which at 825,000 acres of South Texas is bigger than all of Rhode Island. What in tarnation, you deployed the word perfectly, by the way, can a person do with his own 38,000 acres of Texas? Great question, but before answering it, the Texan would like to ask a question of his own. Why in tarnation limit yourself to pretending to be the owner of a measly 38,000 acre place when you could pretend to be the owner of a ranch more than 10 times that size? Fortuitously, the Texanist recently learned of just such a ranch having hit the market out in West Texas. Brewster Ranches, owned by a Kentucky businessman who is reportedly seventh largest landowner in the nation, covers more than 420,000 acres of a ruggedly stunning Big Bend country. It boasts two airstrips, running waterways, and mountain peaks topping 5,000 feet, and is currently the biggest piece of real estate available anywhere in Texas, and it will set you back only $320 million. Dream big or wake up, the Texanist always says. What rewarding activities would the Texanist engage in if he had such a spread splayed out before him? Well, he might raise livestock, ride horses, farm, hunt, fish, camp, rodeo, watch sunsets, cook out, have friends over, stargaze, learn to play a mouth harp, drink whiskey out of a clear glass bottle, plink things, paint landscapes, watch sunrises, write poetry, swim in the Buff, and be a good steward of his huge personal piece of Texas. Or put more simply, just ranch a lot. While you're waiting for your cotton to get tall enough for you to be able to afford such a place, the Texans would direct you to Texas Farm and Ranch, a publication affiliated with the Texas Monthly Mothership that showcases exceptional specimens of rural real estate that are up for sale. It's sometimes referred to around offices ranch porn. PSA, do not Google ranch porn. And it sounds like something that would be right up your alley. Maybe it will help tide you over until the day your Texas-sized dreams are finally realized. When that happens, please be sure that you engage in one more traditional ranch activity that no self-respecting Texas landowner would deny himself: inviting Texas's self-described foremost advice columnist over for a long visit. And with that, my friends, we come to the end of our reading for today. Been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
HEB and Favor Delivery have introduced a new service that allows customers to have grocery essentials delivered to their doorstep in 2 hours or less. In addition to HEB curbside and home delivery, shoppers can use Favor's new Express Delivery service. With Express Delivery, customers can choose up to 25 items from a selected list of groceries. For more information, go to newsroom.heb.
Of all the interesting places in our country, the American West may just have the most interesting stories. Recording Library of West Texas volunteer Jack reads articles from Range, American Cowboy, and other publications on the Western Magazine Hour, Wednesday mornings at 11 and again Sunday afternoons at 5 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 91 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the June issue of Texas Highways, and our first article is titled Let Freedom Ring. Juneteenth celebrations around the world mark the day enslaved Texans were finally notified of their freedom 155 years ago, by Michael Hurd. For several of my adolescent years in the 1960s, my family motored 45 miles northwest on U.S. 290 from southeast Houston's Sunnyside neighborhood to Prairie View's small community of African-American farmers. There, we joined several other black families for what was billed as a picnic. It became a much-anticipated ritual that, to me, had no significance other than an opportunity to spend a day in the country gorging on fried chicken, barbecue, burgers, hot dogs, red soda water, and soul food dishes, and wallowing in an itchy bed of hay tugged by a clattering tractor. When the appointed day arrived in June, my brother, sister, and I gave a whoop as we piled into the back seat of the family car, and away we went for a fun holiday outing. If there was a reverential aspect to the day, it never registered with me, my siblings, or the other 24 or so kids with whom we exhausted ourselves eating, racing around, and playing softball and other energetic games. Despite my innocence, I'd like to think the adults who brought us together for their annual Juneteenth celebration did at some point kick around a few conversations reflecting on the occasion's true purpose. While slamming dominoes and talking noise, playing the card game bid whist, and gossiping, they must have discussed June 19, 1865, when black Texans became some of the last of 4 million enslaved African Americans formally notified of their freedom. Perhaps the adults acknowledged the history or, like us kids, just enjoyed a leisurely day with their friends. I do not doubt that other black families around the state were engaged in similar celebrations for the day saluting African American heritage. The tradition's popularity has grown over 155 years, well beyond the borders of the Lone Star State. If you are in Tokyo, Prague, Seoul, or Paris, France, not East Texas, you are likely to find a Juneteenth celebration. It is the African-American 4th of July, the Emancipation Proclamation, its Declaration of Independence. And, in 1980, thanks to the efforts of late state Rep. Al Edwards of Houston, Texas became the first state to recognize Emancipation Day as an official holiday. Since then, 45 other states and the District of Columbia have made the date a state holiday or acknowledged its observance. Yet the question persists, what is Juneteenth? It's a topic I grappled with embarrassingly late in my life. I nodded through my high school American history and world history classes with disinterest. Black history often wasn't taught. In 1963, my junior high school was renamed Crispus Attucks, and that was when I became aware of the black hero who was the first casualty of the American Revolution. We all thought that was pretty cool, for about a day. I wasn't jolted awake about Juneteenth until I was well into my 30s. At that point, I had served 8 years as an Air Force medic, studied journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, and had become a sports writer at the Austin American Statesman and USA Today. 25 years later, when I started my role as director of Prairie View A&M University's Texas Institute for the Preservation of History and Culture in 2015, I was tasked with digitally documenting 500 years of black history in Texas. As a kid, I celebrated Juneteenth in Prairie View, and now I'm privileged to research, write, and display exhibits about the event in that same town. Along the way, I educated myself about black history, picking up bits and pieces from stories and Afrocentric publications like Jet and Ebony magazines. In the late 1980s, I began research for my first book, Black College Football, 1892 to 1992, a history of football programs at historically black colleges. Part of my research focused on how those schools, such as Prairie View A&M, were founded throughout the South after emancipation. When my interest in sports history collided with my interest in black history, I was excited to discover intriguing tales about Juneteenth and everything that came before and after. The roots of Juneteenth were planted by the Proclamation, a tactical military instrument intended to economically thwart the Confederate States Army and restore the Union. President Abraham Lincoln reasoned that freeing slaves in the rebellious states would collapse the Confederates' cotton-based economy by taking away its labor force. He issued a preliminary proclamation in September 1862, warning the rebels to cease fighting and rejoin the Union, or else he would free their slaves on January 1, 1863, which he did by signing the proclamation. In response, the Confederates stood fast. The proclamation applied specifically to secessionist states. The enslaved people were officially notified of their freedom by Union soldiers in areas increasingly under the Union's control. That left Texas slaves unaffected because the state never had the large Union Army presence necessary to enforce the proclamation, which made Texas a safe haven to practice slavery. Slave owners in other southern states seized the opportunity to move the enslaved to Texas, where they were less likely to be freed by Union soldiers. "It looked like everybody in the world was going to Texas," recalled one formerly enslaved man in historian Leon Litwack's book, Been in the Storm So Long, The Aftermath of Slavery. The Civil War ended in April 1865, and 2 months later, Union General Gordon Granger and about 2,000 troops arrived in Galveston to establish the Provisional Department of Texas, an interim government of sorts. Their major task was spreading the word to the 250,000 Texas slaves that they were free. On June 19, 1865, General Order No. 3 was issued. Quote, "The people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the Executive of the United States, all slaves are free." As Galveston native and historian Sharon Batiste Gillens describes in her 2018 essay, The Day Freedom Came, the announcement of freedom brought the eruption of spontaneous celebrations by freedmen and their supporters throughout the city. But why had it taken 2.5 years for word to reach Texas? The most plausible explanation is painfully simple. Slave owners ignored the proclamation and continued reaping the profits from cotton and corn harvests. Some of the formerly enslaved spoke in the Texas Slave Narratives, a federal writers' project that interviewed and collected firsthand accounts of slavery from 1936 to 38. The subjects reported not being freed for several months or years, even after Granger's arrival in Galveston. According to University of North Texas historian Elizabeth Hayes Turner, one former slave, Katie Darling, continued working for her mistress another 6 years after emancipation and said, "She whipped me after the war just like she did for." No Juneteenth celebration could ever match the initial jubilation of enslaved Texans when they got the news and ventured off into a great unknown, freedom, wherever and whatever that was. Almost 250 years of unspeakable human misery, from the distant shores of Africa to the sweaty, bloody despair of Texas soil, came to a close. Even the most unsure and frightened of the new freedmen had to stop and measure the history, and remember the thousands of ancestors whose forced journey did not include living to see Emancipation Day. Juneteenth was first celebrated in 1866, 1 year after emancipation. Freedmen and their families gathered in rural communities and burgeoning freedom colonies to rejoice with parades, dances, church services, hallelujahs, community feasts, and tears. In East Texas's Anderson County, freedmen created fireworks by drilling holes in trees and filling them with gunpowder. Some communities purchased land specifically to hold their celebrations, such as when Houston's Reverend Jack Yates raised $1,000 in 1872 for what would be named Emancipation Park in the Third Ward. A similar effort in 1898 in Mahia yielded Booker T. Washington Park, which often saw 20,000 celebrants at its Juneteenth events. However, according to Turner, there was a noticeable shift in Juneteenth celebrations after World War I. African Americans were forced to examine their emancipation celebrations after World War I, since few civil rights were furthered, and segregation, the threat of violence, and voter suppression in southern states expanded, she says. Juneteenth celebrations that once had included long and inspiring speeches by black politicians, who had given voice to political ambition and civil rights, turned instead to venues of entertainment and commercialism. Today's events follow that trend with parades, R&B blues and hip-hop concerts, health screenings, and job fairs. But a typical modern Juneteenth celebration might also include prayer breakfasts and reflections on the plight of black communities, panel discussions featuring prominent historians, and an emphasis on passing along knowledge and appreciation of heritage and culture to the youth. By celebrating Juneteenth, we celebrate the many Black Texans who not only endured, but survived and created a community whose legacy of accomplishments will extend far beyond their lifetimes, says Ron Goodwin, a history professor at Prairie View A&M.